Gnosis. I'm your host, Deacon John, joined by my co-host, Jason Memo. Hello, Jason.
Hello there.
And we've got Dr. Ed Lincoln, scholar, professor, and author of The Theater of the Occult Revival, who's going to be talking to us about The Theater of the Occult Revival, as well as theater, gnosis, gnosticism, occultism, all that good stuff. Hello, Dr. Lincoln. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So before we can raise up the curtain and have the first act start, we have a little bit of an introduction, which sucks, but then, hey, if this is the first time I've ever listened to the show, don't turn it off. But this is where we beg you for money. We can't do the show without your financial support. So you can help us out by signing up and subscribing at patreon.com/gnostic for as little as $1 per piece of media per month. In return, you get the shows early. And if there's anything else we could do for you, let us know. We usually only charge for, 4 to 5 pieces of media a month. We try to make more. And we want to give our patrons. Our patrons more, but we don't want to lock up any content behind a paywall. So, if you want something from us, just let us know. But we actually can't do the show without those dirty shackles. PayPal.com/Gnostic for one-time donations. And we know that these are difficult times and you may not be able to help us out with money. You can also like and subscribe. You can tell people about the show. You can share it on your social media. That really helps us out a lot. Okay, so Dr. Lincoln, this is a show that I always open the show if we're really excited and pumped, but that's because we have the best guests in the world and we're very passionate about the topic. But I'm a recovering playwright and director. Jason is presently a theater professional, so this is a topic that's very close to our hearts, to our careers, and into some of our wider passions. Dr. Lincoln, can you tell us, what is the occult revival, even though we've talked about it before on the show, the so-called occult revival, and what does it have to do with theater?
Okay, well, from my standpoint, the occult revival is a sudden upsurge in interest in creating worldviews that are built on esoteric practices, particularly practices that offer means of contacting the supernatural, or practices that offer means of manipulating an otherwise invisible reality and pulling invisible or occult hidden sources from that realm and using it to achieve certain purposes. And usually when people talk about the occult revival, the names that come up, like in the United States in the 1840s to 1850s, it's the Fox Sisters and spiritualism. And then in Europe, always Eliphas Levi pops up as in 1856, his book on the secrets of high magic, weight translated as transcendental magic in English. And then we think about the rise of societies dedicated to the practice of magic, like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn is obviously one of the big players in that scene. And then we, as well, we have the rise of theosophy and the breakoff groups like Anthroposophy and groups like that. So what you had was this really fascinating time where all these groups popped up, and so as far as the occult revival is concerned, you have this upsurge of these groups and these organizations and individuals who start getting interested in these things. And as far as its connections to theater, I would say that connection really starts to become apparent with the emergence of symbolism. First in France, and then in Russia, and then in between, because the symbolists were really interested in, be they poets or musicians or theater artists, they were really interested in somehow invoking the invisible, the otherwise invisible, through their art. So for me, that's where it really starts to happen, is around 1880, 1890s, we start to see theater artists suddenly really interested in the occult revival. And most of them, almost all of them, are already deeply involved in it on some level.
Yeah. And the Do you see a link between theater and occult ritual that's not really there with other forms of art? Like, of course, we have talked about on the show before, you mentioned that it's not just theater. You know, these occultists are intersecting with the symbolist movement. So you have painting, you have music, you have other artistic disciplines. But do you feel like there's something really special, a strong connection between the theatrical performance and ritual performance? And was there connections between theater and the occult before the so-called occult revival?
Oh, well, let's start with that. The connections between theater and the occult revival go back to the origins of, I mean, the correct connections between theater and the invisible realm, what in modern terms we might call the occult realm, the spiritual realm, those go all the way back to the beginning of theater. You know, most people will start talking about it in Greece. You know, they'll look at Greece, and the truth is that the initial Greece performances were those famous tragedies that we know of, and even the comedies that we know of were part of a event that started in the 6th century in Greece, and it blew up and got bigger and bigger, called the City Dionysia. Dionysus is the god of the god of theater, and so those initial plays were part of the mysteries of Dionysus. And yet there were also other dramatic mysteries that were done in secret, the mystery cults of the time period. And we have ancient writers like Pausanias who wrote a lot about the mysteries of Eleusis. And I also went to, I took a group of students to South Italy, and we went to Pompeii, and they talked about how, in addition to the Roman theater in Pompeii, the external Roman theater, there was once a secret theater that had rites. And many people have argued that, including Edward Charest, some of the great thinkers of the occult revival, did research, and they believe, some people believe that there was a connection between the rituals that were done for the public at the tragedies, and then the you know, the theaters done, the theater done there, and then possibly mystery dramatics that were done in secret for initiated members of a specific cult. But even before that, because many people say they look at Greece, but the truth is there's a document like the Stele of Ikernephrit, which is an Egyptian document dating back to the Middle Kingdom, so somewhere between 1700 BCE and 2000 BCE. There's a document that clearly states there were dramatic rituals being performed where they're performing the life and death of Osiris at that point. So that connection between the occult and drama is organic, and it goes back a really long time. And what was interesting about the people in the theater of the occult revival is they were, in my opinion, trying to put really religiosity and theater back together, because it had been officially separated by kings and queens in England somewhere around, I think it was Queen Elizabeth, said no more religious theater was allowed around 1559 in England. And that kind of followed suit all over Europe because of the problems that happened with the Protestant Reformation, and people were putting on kind of inflammatory, or they weren't trying to be inflammatory necessarily, but a Catholic drama was suddenly very controversial in a Protestant area. So the occult revival in theater, what happened there that was really special was that they were really trying to put the spirituality back into theater, which had been sort of legally and socially removed for centuries at that point.
Wow, so cool. And how did you come to become interested in this topic and to write your book? Because I'm assuming it must be a bit of a niche within theater studies, within
It
the
is.
academia. Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, when I first started working on it, all except for one teacher, almost all of my professors were like, "What are you doing? This is this important? It seems really weird." Well, how it really happened is when I was studying for my PhD, I had this amazing, and I'd always been interested in the occult. I myself have practiced magic, and I'm just generally, I'm into occult art, and you know, I think I really got interested in it because I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian home, and people would come in and talk about the reality of the occult, and I instead of driving me away from it, I got really interested in it. And so by the time I got into theater, I had started watching and listening to everything I could that kind of had to do with that, because I'd been told it was absolutely real, you know. And I don't think real is the important question when it comes to it. But by the time I moved to Manhattan, and then I started getting my PhD. I grew up in Houston, Texas, but I moved to Manhattan. I started working on my PhD after living there many years. And there was this an amazing scholar who you might be interested in his work, named Daniel Gerald is his name. And he ended up being my mentor. I studied under him, and he was the chair of my dissertation. And he was one of the first scholars to start writing about the symbolists and writing about their connections to the occult, and not in a pejorative way, but rather talking about it as an interesting social development. And when I was reading it, because of the work I had done in the past out of my own interest, I realized that a lot of the language these people were using in their plays and in their theories about theater were drawn from esoteric theories. And I became interested in wondering, I wonder if those symbolist artists were occultists, and I wonder if occultists in that time period were interested in symbolist art. And what I discovered when I was studying, I discovered that pretty much every symbolist artist working between the late 19th century and, say, 1920 was at least tangentially connected to an occult movement or organization, or they were quite devoted. And then I also discovered that almost every famous occultist from that time period, Rudolf Steiner, Aleister Crowley, Catherine Tingley, they had direct connections to the avant-garde theater of that time as well. And that's really how that book came about, because what I did that was different is I wrote a book about occultists who tried to make theater for occult purposes. And that's how that came about. It's kind of a long path, but it got there.
Yeah. No, that's super cool. Yeah. And, you know, I've mentioned before on the show, one of the things that kind of brought me to Gnosticism was the symbolists, because it's my favorite art movement. So both the visual, but particularly the music, right? Particularly Satie. So reading about Satie and finding out some of the connections that he had, and then finding out about this thing. And then it led me to, our branch of Gnosticism, which comes out of, the French occult revival for the most part, although it has some earlier roots as well. But one of the things. Anyways, we love talking about the intersections between art, imagination, spirituality on the show. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, Jason.
I wanted to kind of jump in there because there's a lot of details about a lot of the figures in your book that I think we want to get into, but because I don't want to, I don't want us to end up having spent all our time just on that level of detail. I want to kind of go up to like kind of a bird's eye view. This is more of a speculative question, but so your book is pretty localized in time and in a certain time.
Yes.
Place, which I think is great.
Yeah. There's a final chapter that kind of starts, but that's like, it's like more this relates to the present in this way. It's really about the occult revival. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is to kind of take it out of that specific time and place, but to speculate is like, Jonathan's already mentioned, like we've had previous shows. We want to do more shows on specific artists who had esoteric history or connections to their work. We did a show on Peladon, but I think like, I also want to just touch on the gnosis of art, like the experience of making art, and whether or not like, or how that can be a Gnostic experience, the experience of consuming art and how that can be a Gnostic experience. And this is very, very personal to me in the sense that, I was raised Lutheran without a strong level of theology or detail in that. It was just kind of like more almost united or as like general Christian, I would say. And it wasn't until I'd encountered Gnosticism and descriptions of the experience of it and its history and its cosmology that I'd found anything, that I found a spirituality that connected to what I feel like when I'm and consume art.
Yeah.
So that's why it's a very personal connection to me. So I guess my question to you is that either theater specifically or art in general, is is that an avenue you find for a Gnostic or mystical experience, whether or not, like, without getting too tied down by a definition of Gnosticism or a definition of Gnosticism?
I would say yes. For me, when I think about Gnosis, people will talk about knowledge, but for me, Gnosis relates to a knowledge that you are born with. It relates to a knowledge that you don't really have to strive to have, but it relates to a knowledge that you have to experience. So Gnosis to me doesn't necessarily mean understanding so much as it means experiencing the divine in a moment. For me, performance, theater, either whether you're doing it as the writer, or if you're doing it as the performer, or you're doing it as an audience member, there is often, you don't get it all the time, but there's often this really amazing moment where it feels like everyone in the room has lost an identity, has lost their identity, and they're all kind of one experiencing some kind of a truth that's beyond even the performance itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I would say that's the same in ritual as well. Whatever your ritual is, like, you know, if you have a divine experience in a moment of participating in performance in a church, in a Carolian Gnostic mass, in a Wiccan ritual, there are these moments where you're kind of lifted out of your limited perception of self. And I do think that performance and participating in, being a part of that, can often be a catalyst to that sort of experience.
And to even just speculate just an ounce further, and then we'll get back into the really interesting meat there, is that also something that is possible between art and audience, even when the participants are not intentionally striving for that purpose?
Yeah. Yes. I think you'll often talk to people who, they'll go in to see something and they'll think, I didn't think it was going to be that good, but then, oh my God, I was completely moved, or I got lost in that particular performance. And I think that when people say that, there's an acknowledgement of, they got past their expectations, they got past sort of personal demands and expectations on the moment, and they were lifted somewhere else. And so I think this is something that can potentially happen in any art form. I mean, I can talk to you more about what I think is particularly special about theater and performed ritual and that sort of thing. But I think there is something about experiencing many different forms of art that can just lift us right out of, you know, for a moment you forget you're in a body, for a moment you are somewhere else, and then you come back. And those eternal moments, another scholar named Marvin Carlson has said about theater, he's called it the eternal instant. You know, those eternal instants are why we look at art. That's what I believe, you know. So
that is great. It was kind of a leading question, but that's a beautiful answer. The eternal moment, did you say?
The eternal instant.
Well, maybe my last question, this will kind of bring us back to our points here, where I think, like, to hear why you think that theater maybe is particularly suited to that. And then we can get kind of into the details of the figures in your book.
To me, what's amazing about theater as a performance form is it's a place where all the arts come together, really. They all come together. Painting comes together, projection comes together, live performance comes together, costume comes together, writing comes together. You can put virtually anything. Theater is like kind of like an artistic soup bowl. You know, where you can just, like, put everything in there, and they all create this one. So you have the many into the one, right, in theater. Mm-hmm. And it's required. That's just how the art works. And I think because of that, you have a really nice example of a mystical concept being played out. And I don't think, for instance, it's a coincidence that in ancient Greece, it was Dionysus who was associated with theater, because theater is something where, in order to perform it, you have to give up your identity. You know, mm-hmm. in order to create it, you have to build this thing. It has to be built, and then at the end of the performance, it has to be dismembered, and then it's rebuilt again. You know, so for me, the connections between the gnosis, you know, the experience of gnosis or the occult experience and theater makes sense. And also, when you listen to or if you read, you know, I think about, like, you know, in something like The Secret Doctrine by Madame Blavatsky, Eliphas Levy's writings, Aleister Crowley says it over and over again in his writings. Catherine Tingley, who most people haven't read, but I have a whole chapter about her in my book. They talk about the idea that great theater artists, and it would relate to any other artist as well, but for them, it's very much about theater because they're very theater oriented. All those people were. They'll talk about, oh, Aeschylus, Shakespeare, Goethe, these different writers, and they'll say they weren't just artists, they were seers. Mm-hmm. Rudolf Steiner said it as well. You know, he's like, whether they knew it or not, they're showing us a picture of a spiritual reality. You know, I think that there is a whole, especially if we're going to go to fin de siècle, there is just a huge body of literature, both in theater and outside of theater, in theater and in the occult, the realm of occult literature, that really makes an argument that alongside the spiritual kind of pulses of humanity, there's a theater that's pulsing along with it, you know, the whole time. And so that's just a really popular concept that popped up in during the occult revival, you know.
Extremely love cool. It.
Well, maybe I'll come back to the book, but before we kind of dive into the movements and some of the figures that you discuss in your book, in your critical opinion, was any of this theatrical art any good? Because we've been exposed to lots of great occult work, but also lots of suck.
Yes, I agree with you. There is a lot of suck. And the truth is, when you look at theater in general, there's a lot of suck. I mean, it really is true, right? And you think back even to Aristotle's time, right? And he's talking about, you know, he's talking about 3, 4, 5, 6 tragedians. And basically his argument is Euripides is a hack, right? Like, if you read Poetics, and Euripides is my favorite of the tragedians, which means that maybe I have poor taste. But his point is there are three people worth talking about at length, and that's Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. And then there are these other people, some of them did some pretty good stuff, but his whole point is the vast majority of the people writing and performing are just terrible. Like that seems to be part of his argument, is that most people just aren't creating good work. And the truth is, how much work is really high quality? So what happened during the occult revival, I think, that was really interesting, is you really had a period where you had W.B. Yeats writing some really amazing poetic drama. You had all those amazing symbolist writers, like, you know, you had Andreev in Russia, you had Maeterlinck, originally from Belgium, but ultimately writing in France, just writing these amazing pieces. But there's a lot of dross in that time period as well. But I think that one of the things that happens in occult art when we see it, and I think the same would have been true back in the height of the occult revival, is that there's a lack of care for aesthetics. Like during the occult revivals, aesthetics were everything. I mean, it was like you look at, you know, they had these beautiful gold objects. They had these, you know, they had Satie, these amazing composers coming in and creating these works, and they were doing this. And when I look at, you know, for instance, in certain rituals I've participated in now, it's not really about aesthetics a lot of the time. A lot of the times it's about personal experience using whatever you have, and not everyone there is some amazing great performer, or maybe it's more about the spiritual idea than it's about the aesthetic. And when you get a really amazing work, usually it's somebody who cares about the aesthetic as much as they care about the content. So for instance, I've seen many, many different performances of Crowley's Gnostic Mass, many, many different ones. And some are, you know, they're just really people doing their best, but it's about the experience. And then some have been, you know, more ornate and well rehearsed, and, you know, and that sort of thing. So and I went to Dornach, Switzerland, and I saw all four of Steiner's mystery plays performed there back in 2000. And each of those plays is about 6 hours long in performance. So it's a long process, but I will say those plays were gorgeous. They were absolutely beautiful. And my wife ran screaming from the space because it was just so long, you know, but it was beautiful. And she, you know, and then there, you know, so I think that there was a demand, there was an understanding of the I think the spiritual power of, or at least the otherwise inexplicable occult impact, you know, of beautiful, well-crafted aesthetics that some people take that seriously, and or have a capacity for that, you know. And I think most people don't, you know. And so a lot of times when I see different types of performance, I don't tend to go in with the same sort of critical eye that I'm going to go in with when I like go to Broadway or something. Mm-hmm. There, the aesthetics better damn well be good because it's $300 a ticket, right? but I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there's Oh, okay.
Thank you.
It's sort of that mix of like, because I think especially with a lot of esoteric stuff, we have we're so engaged with the subject that we forget we need to bring the audience on board with being as engaged, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, and it also impacts the performer. I mean, it very much impacts the performer. I mean, if you're gonna do some rite that involves something as simple as a cup and a wand, and the touch, the feel, the weight, the look of those objects impact, even if you're alone in a room, the touch and the feel and the look of those objects, they impact you, you know?
Yeah.
So they're certainly going to impact anybody who's watching you.
Exactly.
Well, you know?
Yeah. So we've talked about theosophy before on the show, and we have discussed its intersections between theosophy and art, but mostly painting and music. What does it have to do with theater?
Well, the I often will go to when you look at a lot of the people who talk about theosophy as performers. I mean, one of the people who's kind of undercredited is Edward Charest. He's a French symbolist playwright, actually proto symbolist. He was even a little earlier, but he was writing during that time period. He was a theosophist. And you read what Blavatsky has to say again in The Secret Doctrine, and Kandinsky, you read what Kandinsky says about color and things like that. Theosophy kind of provided a formula of artistic theurgy for symbolist authors, but also for occultists who were trying to use art to invoke or to use art to otherwise unite with the divine in existence. And I do think that a lot of Theosophy's theories about artists as magicians and particularly as theurgists impacted in a major way, it impacted the symbolist movement. But I think also their theories remain influential, even though maybe they've been passed down through other artists more than through Theosophy itself. I've actually been very fortunate when I wrote my chapter on Tingley, Catherine Tingley, in my book. I developed a nice, close working relationship with the Theosophical Society in America, and they allow me to go there and stay on their property and go through archives. And the amount of time I've spent there, it really is a central concept, the idea that performance and theater and really all art forms, they can be inspired by a connection with the divine, and a great deal of art from the Theosophical perspective is a physical outgrowth and manifestation of that connection.
Yeah. And I find over the last couple of years, really the last couple of decades, Aleister Crowley, his literary output has been getting more acclaim, more notice.
Yes.
You know, critics are looking at it as important. His poetry, the White Stains is now viewed as a very important early queer text, right?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. So I understand that. Crowley also wrote plays with his new literary critical reevaluation. Can you tell us about his work as a director, a playwright, an actor, his connections with theater?
Well, sure. I mean, there's so much to say on Crowley. He was definitely he was a man of the theater from top to bottom. His most famous directing job was definitely The Rites of Eleusis, which he performed in 1910 at Caxton Hall in England. The Rites of Eleusis are a series of rituals that invoked different gods, and ultimately, if I'm not mistaken, by the end, each god invoked was also dead by the end of that rite, because he was announcing the new eon. He was announcing the new eon, which was going to move humanity away from the formula of the dying god as understood by Fraser and the Abrahamic religion, Christianity in particular. But even before that, all the dying god forms. But that was a very, very notorious performance. And it was really, that performance was a big part of how he started to get his notorious reputation, because a lot of journalists, let's call them journalists, but they were writing for the tabloids, right? A lot of people said things were going on in that performance, which it's been pretty well documented were not actually going on. But he also, if you read Magic and Theory and Practice, he has a whole chapter on what he calls dramatic ritual. And according to him, magic, invocation, the art of invocation, there are three forms, and in his opinion, the dramatic form, which involves the taking on theurgy again, uniting with the persona of a deity and performing its life story or performing some action as that deity. In his opinion, if you're a performance-oriented artist, he thinks that's the best form of invocation that you could employ. So he did the Rites of Eleusis, and he wrote many, many plays. I'm actually putting together an anthology of his plays that I hope to publish. Not long ago, I guess it was 2016, I republished in PAJ, which is a performance art journal. It's called PAJ, a Journal of Performance and Art. But I republished one of his plays called The Savior. And I published it with a little article about how I thought it related to World War I, which was raging at the time when he wrote it. But I would say he wrote, I think he wrote at least, oh, I'd say 18, 20 plays. Oh, wow. And some of them are good and some of them are not, quite frankly, you know, but he's an amazing writer. And The Savior, I thought, was a great piece of spiritual criticism. And he also was an impresario. After Rites of Eleusis didn't go well for him, he put together a group of, it was like a vaudeville, not a vaudeville show, but it was a traveling review with a bunch of women who played violin and danced, and he called it the Ragged Ragtime Girls, and they toured around Russia. And when they were touring, that's when he wrote the Gnostic Mass. He was inspired by the Russian Orthodox Mass. And he was inspired by that when he wrote the Gnostic Mass. But I would say that for him, he says it very clearly, ritual is a play, you know, and he, if you read his autobiography, he's constantly referencing Maeterlinck. He talks about, of course, you know, he had a big rivalry with Yeats, but he and Yeats were both symbolists as well, you know, and I often just kind of lump Crowley in as another symbolist playwright, and for whom there was no distinction between spirituality and art. It wasn't there.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Crowley's Gnostic Mass a few times, the famous Gnostic Mass. Does theater have anything to do with his Gnostic Mass?
Theater?
Yeah.
Well, I'd say yes, because if you read that piece, the level of stage directions in it are only a playwright would write it like that. You know, if you look at, you know, if we look at like most, you know, liturgical texts, they don't go too far into detail about everything everyone should be wearing or how many times they should walk in this direction and what the floor should look like. We have to have black and white checkered floor, absolutely essential. Discussions about the disrobing of the priestess behind the veil and whether or not she disrobes when it's opened again. The descriptions he's giving in there, they read more like a playwright than a magician, you know? Yeah. And I'm of the opinion that, and he says it himself, I'm in the opinion that it's a play. You know, it's a symbolist play. But again, a symbolist play is also a ritual. There's not really much in the way of distinction between those.
This is amazing. Like I said at the beginning, it was kind of a leading question about the whole aesthetic experience as always a potential for gnosis or mysticism. But it's been a real focus for me. I did a talk, so we do a conclave every year, and then that is usually like kind of a conference and people have various presentations, and my presentation was essentially around Gnosticism and narrative theory and narrative ideas, and that in some respects, rather than or alongside discussing a Gnostic text from a historical or a like a theological analysis, that it's also like looking at these texts as literary texts and like these folks as people who are engaged in a literary interaction with each other. Mm-hmm. I think is kind of opens them up in interesting ways as well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things I've really been getting into lately is in the study, looking at the scholarly study of magic, and I'm also an artist. I write plays, I perform, I do film. I'm a musician, you know. So I'm an artist, and to me, I'm the same. I'm a symbolist. There's no distinction. Art is religion. It's all the same. It's all the same thing to me.
Yeah.
But what I think is interesting is the idea of the need to separate theater from religion, or from many scholars and also practitioner standpoints, the need to separate magic from religion. Mm-hmm. That need to separate is, in my opinion, often just kind of uncritically held onto by people.
An idea that's striking me, like the do you know the podcast Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast?
No, I haven't heard it. I'll have to watch it. Listen.
That might be your new obsession, because he's going through everything in a very slow way, which is great. But anyway, he made a point, and I can't remember what period it is, but he was saying that there's a point around the beginning of Christianity really becoming a forceful movement, mm-hmm. that the idea of truth became really important, that that it wasn't just enough that you believed what you believed, but you believed what you believed, and it had to be true for everybody, if that makes sense. You had to enforce that or expand that.
Like universal truth.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And I'm to bring it back, is that I think there's a sense in religion that one religion or another must be true, and art is often storytelling, therefore fiction, therefore false.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so let's keep those apart.
And it's also a protection of what you're separating, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing is the separation of say magic and religion, that's pre-Christian. That goes back to the ancient Greeks, that they view religion as it came from Zoroaster, it came from Persia. Not the same as our official religions. The mm-hmm. story of Medea is the story of a strange foreign witch, and then we go into the late antiquity, post-Julian Christian era, then it's, theater, that's what the Romans were doing in the Colosseum, that's totally anti-Christian, we have to separate that out. So there's a really interesting parallel between the sort of rejection of theater and the rejection of magic in society. It's really interesting.
Well, that's great. I think I heard Jonathan come back, and Jonathan, I hope you can edit in some of what we just talked about.
I'm positive I can. Or I'll just do a little edit and keep this conversation in right now, and just let people look behind the curtain, to use a very appropriate metaphor. But I'll tie it back off with Crowley's Gnostic Mass, which I've attended many times, and definitely see it as a theatrical work. And that's also a magical ritual, which can be very powerful and transcendent. But if the actors, the performers don't do it well, it's awful. Right, and I'm like, this is not even awful; it's silly.
The piece is like designed to. I often say I didn't make this up, but a wise person once said to me, "Theater is the art that wants to fail." And man, the Gnostic Mass is written with failure all over it. It's like got so many requirements to it. And if you can't lose yourself in the moment of it, you're right. It's just a weird, awkward thing.
When they pull it off, it's like...
It's amazing. And I've performed in it as well. I've played the child role, and I've also deaconed a few times in that. That's a piece that I thoroughly think is a wonderful, wonderful piece. And when you do it with a group of really great ritualists, and you're all on the same page, and you're trying to transcend the difficulty, because it's difficult, the kind of the complexity of the actions that are being asked of you. And I think that, it can be a really powerful piece. And I've had I'm happy to say that I've had more good experiences with that one than I've had awkward ones.
So you mentioned the 18 hours worth of Steiner plays.
Yes, that's amazing.
Can you tell us about what Steiner and his followers thought about live theater, and what Steiner thought plays could do?
Yeah, well, Steiner was He became controversial in the Theosophical movement when he started. He wrote his first two mystery dramas, The Portal of Initiation and The Soul's Awakening. That's the name of those two. He wrote those before World War I broke out. And at that point, he was still a card-carrying member of the Theosophical Society. And what he was really trying to do with that is he firmly believed that he, and I believe he believed it, you know, I believe this is, I really have a lot of respect for Steiner, to be honest. He really lived and died by what he was saying. But he believed that he could perceive spiritual realms. He perceived these entities, Ahriman and Lucifer, and these soul forces, and he perceived auras and a spiritual realm and an astral realm, and all these things were very complicated for him. What he was trying to do with the mystery dramas is he was trying to show, to the best of his ability, an accurate representation of what he was perceiving, right? So he wrote the story about a character named Johannes who's going through these different levels of initiation. And in this case, initiation is not necessarily done through an order. It's an organic process that happens through a self-taught system, which that aligns with theosophy very well. So what he really thought was, by showing us this picture that he saw, this story that he saw, that it would awaken an organ, like literally a physical organ within us, that would enable us to begin to perceive the same realms that he was perceiving. So for him, he was trying to kind of jumpstart the capacity for clairvoyance within the audience member.
Okay, extremely, extremely cool. And so when you saw the 18th, did it work? When you saw the 18 hours worth of plays?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you sit through a play that's 7 hours long, you will go into clairvoyant states no matter what. I mean, one of the most amazing, it was sad, but the amazing thing I saw was there was this woman and we were all watching this play and I was the only person there who wasn't you know, my German's really bad, you know, but I was there and there's this woman like three seats over from me and we'd been sitting there. This is like day two of like the marathon and she literally fell out of her chair, you know, shabunk. And then people were all around her and got her back up, you know. Steiner demands long dedicated concentration. So it becomes a beautiful meditational experience, you know, and I kind of think because I knew the plays, I'd studied them, but my German isn't as great as I would like. And so there was something actually kind of nice about that, you know, that half the time I didn't understand what they were saying, but I knew where we were in the story because I knew the plays, you know. He demands, he wants to meditate. He says in one of his writings, when you come into the Gertianum, I'm speaking from higher self to higher self. That's what I'm doing. So It's not about the words, you know, even though he was very wordy, you know, but it was about something else, you know, and he didn't expect logical understanding. That's not really part of the experience. But the thing about those plays is they're in the Gertianum. And I don't know if you've ever seen images of the Gertianum.
I have, but please describe it, yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's a 1,000-seat theater. And there are very few right angles anywhere. It's like, honestly, it's like Dr. Seuss carved a theater out of clay is what it feels like when you go in there. And he has these one-colored monochromatic stained glass windows just running the top and the bottom of this huge space when you go in. And the plays start in the morning and the sun is just shooting these beams of single colored light through the room. It is just one of the most astounding spaces. So we were talking about aesthetics. Steiner understood aesthetics, you know, and when you walk in there, it's amazing. You feel like you are in another universe the moment you walk in there. And it was just so powerful. you know.
So we recently did as Jason mentioned, or as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, an almost 2-hour episode on Josephine Peladon, and about his work, his curation of other people's work, but mostly talking about his writing, the curation of visual art, some of his connections to composers. But theater didn't come up. Did he also have connections to theater? Did he write plays?
Or? He wrote plays. He wrote plays. If you go on archive.org. You can find plays. Not very many of those that I found have been translated from French to English, but they are there. In fact, right before this podcast, I wanted to make sure I wasn't remembering wrong, and I went there, and I was like, no, there it is. They have a 3-act Peladon play right there. He also wrote novels. I went to Paris once, and I bought an old paperback copy of one of his novels. I also happen to have written an article about Peladon's Rosencross Salon. It was in 2016. They had an exhibition of the Rosencross Peladon art, and that was at the Guggenheim in New York. And PAJ, writing for PAJ, I went there and I looked at a lot of the work there and a lot of the paintings, and I wrote an article about that with some illustrations. And so even beyond, you know, traditional performance, he would have these salons where, you know, there would be art around the room, and then they'd play some Satie music, and then they'd perform some short scenes, and they would have these really fascinating, and I think this was all done at a chapel in Notre Dame, it was a very serious artistic endeavor, and yeah, performance was definitely part of Peladon's, vocabulary.
So probably the most widespread, popular, well-known, seeing a huge wave and resurgence among the youth is when it comes to esoteric movements, would be Wicca or witchcraft. Mm-hmm. What does Wicca have to do with an obscure Rosicrucian theater troupe?
Well, you know, I wrote that chapter in my book because I was surprised to discover that nobody had ever talked about Alex Matthews, who had that group, and nobody had really talked about that Gardner had been a part of that organization. So there was a guy named Alex Matthews who had a Rosicrucian theater in southern England. And near Christchurch, which is near where Gardner was doing his stuff ultimately. So before Gardner went on his own, he was doing these plays. He was part of this theater group. And it seems like, you know, he came back from the islands where he'd lived years as a plantation. He had Gardner. He is Gardner at this point. And when he came back to America, he was looking for interesting people to hang out with. You know how esoteric people are. They're always looking for their group of people to hang out with. And he went and he did several plays. And I found evidence that he was in a play. It was listed in a paper in this Rosicrucian theater that doesn't exist anymore. And that really is the connection right there is he was participated in that. And then he went on and he wrote Witchcraft Today. But again, he was also connected with Crowley. He was, I've also been to the Warburg Institute and I saw, a couple of letters that he wrote to Crowley. He was, I think, approaching a seventh degree level in the Ordo Templi Orientis. But bottom line is, when you read Witchcraft Today, he's talking about ritual as drama as well, you know. And of course, with Wicca, drama is much more intimate. It's not something you necessarily have to make a big show out of, right? They're not necessarily trying to make a big theatery piece, although that happens as well. You know, like here in Ohio, we have the Starwood Festival that pops up, and there's a lot of Wiccan performance that appears in there. But I think this idea of a sacred theater, a sacred ritual drama,
is central to Wicca, you know? And so I think the reason that's important is he's interested in theater. He's interested in Crowley because, you know, and no small part of that is the ritual of it. I mean, you don't have to know much about Wicca to know that Gardner loved his theatrics, you know? And and he loved his props, and he loved he liked to go out and do the circle, you know, primarily I looked at that Rosicrucian thing as an interesting thing that Gardner did before he went out and found his own path. You know, I kind of feel like Gardner started, he made a choice, you know, because many people talk about is magic public or is it private? You know, many people talk about that. And I think for Gardner, it became semi-private. You know, it's not something you do in front of a bunch of people. And honestly, Crowley went the same way because after he did the Rites of Eleusis and he got dragged through the mud so much, he decided, he even says in Magic and Theory and Practice, it's a play, but you should probably do it for people who are already initiated.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know?
So by the 1940s, really by World War I, but by the 1940s, definitely, you know, this first generation of the occult revival, they're mostly all gone. They're mostly dead. When they died out, when they were gone, did occult theater also die out?
I don't think occult theater died because, A, Steiner was part of that, and that continues, right? If we're going to take Wicca and view that as occult theater, that continues. If you're going to view Crowley, that continues because the rites of Eleusis and the Gnostic Mass are performed continually to this day. So I wouldn't say that they died. And I think maybe another way to view it is, were there any innovations after that, you know? And I think there were, you know, but what I think is interesting is some of those innovations entered the realm of, radical professional theater, you know? So one of the interesting things that some people don't know is the famous, British director, Peter Brook, who worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Before he got out of college, he produced Dr. Faustus. This would have been in the, you know, early 40s. And he actually brought in Crowley to give him notes on how to do the invocation scene. And apparently a very old and extra crazy Crowley was in the auditorium screaming, "You've got to use real blood. It can't be fake." You know, he was in there saying that's one of my favorite stories about Crowley, you know. And Peter Brook was influenced by a theater theorist, one of the most influential theater theorists named Antonin Artaud, a French theorist who started in the 1920s working with lots of people. He was very immersed in the occult revival. He died in the 1950s, but he developed a theory of theater called the theater of cruelty, which remains very influential to this day. Theater of cruelty, the idea is that theater is not supposed to entertain, it's supposed to confront the audience with their abyss, and it's supposed to purge them of things. And by the way, this is really what Aristotle says about tragedy when he's talking about catharsis, you know, the idea that you purge these negative emotions out of yourself by confronting these horrible stories, you know. And so, you know, Artaud wrote some great essays. One of them is called The Alchemical Theater. It's about purifying the self through theater. And then in the late 60s, so we had these groups like the Living Theater, who came out and they started, you know, taking their clothes off and pulling people on the stage and talking about your chakras and all that kind of stuff. But they were what? Professional theater. Mm-hmm. But they were doing an occult thing, you know, and a Gnostic thing, you know, they were trying to anyway. And they really impacted a lot of the direction of performance as it went. And so for me, as time goes on and as performance goes on, I think it's hard to I think we've come past a realm where the occult theater meant, oh, what occult organization are you part of, And we come into a place where people, the idea of micro spiritualities, people are feel very free to make their own idiosyncratic performance. And I think when you look at it that way, there's probably a lot of really good occult theater out there that's hiding as just theater, you know? And I know there are a lot of people on the esoteric side who, you know, who are longing to raise their aesthetic values as well and work in things. But I also just tend to think that theater people, there are a lot of theater people like myself who are just into these things, you know, and, you know, there's really a lot of my own work as an artist connects to that in some way, even if I'm directing Dr. Faustus or if I'm directing The Tempest by Shakespeare. I did a version of The Tempest about 2-3 years ago at my university, and we pulled in all this imagery from John Dee and Enochian magic into that, and it was powerful. It's really interesting to do that. So I think, again, this idea of separating the two things organically, I just don't think it's a clean separation. It's like separating spaghetti from pasta sauce. It doesn't really work very well.
It's kind of what you talked about regarding how theater is like everything in one, you know. It's like a very much that idea of the Solve et Coagula, like bringing it all
together. Absolutely.
Like I'm even just thinking about something like Sleep No More, you know, as a theatrical experience that's in, I think it's still, well, who knows if it's still going in New York. I haven't checked with COVID and everything, but
yeah, I don't know.
But or Mackers with the Three Witches. Considering my group here, I'm superstitious enough to not say the name.
Yeah, you know, it's only supposed to be dangerous in a theater.
I just try to stay out of that habit entirely.
But I'm actually reverse religious about that. Whenever I do a show, before anyone comes in, I walk in the space and I say Macbeth 13 times before I start rehearsing. I do that at the beginning. And anytime I haven't done that, something just horrible has happened in my show. So.
That's amazing. Yeah. Just one other quick thing I wanted to jump in on was that you mentioned that even Aristotle talked about the process of like tragedy helping like remove things from the audience.
Yeah, the catharsis.
But it's like, it's very much like, you know, good art can often be in a way an exorcism.
Yes, and in fact, Artaud describes it as such. So the guy I was talking about, Artaud says theater is not an entertainment, it is an exorcism. You know, so he flat out comes out and says that. I after the show, if you want, I'll find the place where he says that and send it to you. But
that would be great.
That is a central idea for Artaud, is that you've got these negative, and Artaud had a lot of things he was dealing with, and for him, theater helped him that way. But yeah, the idea of theater is an exorcism, and I think the Living Theater took that up as well and said that. But yeah, that's a recurring idea.
Sorry, I'm just riffing now. It's
subject. Exactly. Well, we should start to wrap up. Did you have any other riffs or questions, Jason? Anything else popping into your mind?
You know, I think in a way you answered it already, because I was starting to ask about like what are people making now? Like, what are some artists that are making stuff now, or at least in a more modern or contemporary sense? And I think you've already kind of gone there. Unless there's anything you'd like to specifically?
Well, I think one thing that's really fascinating to me in the age of COVID as well is the amount of huge amount of stuff as far as the occult is concerned that's happening like online. You know, when I'm looking at, you know, I think anyone who's into the occult knows TikTok, right? Like, you go to TikTok and like there are people doing these little mini rituals in there, and I think that somehow there's a little bit of a, and it's not that anybody's doing anything particularly famous, but I think down the road somebody's going to do something really interesting on the occult line, and they're going to do it online. Is how it's going to happen, because man, TikTok has exploded with that, and I just love the kind of art for art's sake, or playing for playing's sake, that's happening on all these different online formats. So I think more than theater,
if you're looking for kind of the occult performance experience, it's really alive online right now. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's great.
Very cool. Well, I've been flashing up the address where people can get the book. I'll also put it in the show notes. But everybody go out and buy a copy of the Theater of the Occult Revival. For my plugs, violentmeditation.substack.com. I work part-time as a meditation coach with secular mindfulness. So for more experience and to meet with my students and my friends and to have a regular meditation time, I do free guided meditation that's good for both beginners and experienced, and it's a mix of guided and silence every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. Montreal time, that's Eastern Standard Time. Jason, your plug is sagetheater.com.
Exactly. So,
yeah. Hey, you can also go to jasonmemel.com.
Exactly.
Yeah, Dr. Lincoln, thanks so much. It's been truly amazing having you. I say this to all the guests. You know, the other guests are going to watch the show and say, he said the same thing to me, but I mean it. But I especially mean it speaking to you because this is a topic that's really near and dear to us. And actually, just about everybody else who works on the podcast has some sort of theater professional background as well. So,
yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks again. And bye, everybody.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye.